If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a few days of vacation. Good to be back in front of the microphone, and especially good to be with our guests this hour, Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Ben.
Chris Larimer with us as well, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Chris.
As usual on Politics Wednesday, we are surveying half a dozen or so topics, recent political topics, both federal, national topics, as well as state topics during the hour. We invite you to join our conversation with your question or observation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about Vice President Harris's trip to Mexico to address what she says are the root causes of the border crisis on our southern border. Also, some state politics. State Auditor Rob Sand in the last few days claiming improper use of federal coronavirus aid by our Governor Reynolds. And also Donald Trump reemerging on the weekend at rallies. Will he retain his grip on the Republican Party? We'll look at those in just a few minutes. But let's start off where NPR did at the top of the hour for some brief comments, perhaps from you, Rachel. The president off to Europe today on the agenda, meetings in Britain with the leaders of the Group of Seven nations, visits to NATO, the European Union. And on the final day in Geneva, he'll be holding his first meeting as president with the president of Russia, Putin. Given that Donald Trump, the previous president, really scorched some longstanding relationships with those close European allies, he threatened to pull out of NATO, he embraced Putin. What are your thoughts on the significance and goals of this first trip to Europe by Biden?
I think Biden's first goal is to reverse every message that Donald Trump sent. So he, you know, in meeting with the G7, he clearly wants to assert that the U.S. is back, ready to take an active role in international organizations and international governance, aligned clearly with U.S. allies. And in his meeting with Putin, you know, interesting that the White House very explicitly said, look, we're meeting with Putin specifically because we see the wide disagreement between the countries. We see the problems in the relationship. And so that's precisely why we want to have this meeting, not to cozy up to Putin, not to reward Russia for bad behavior in cyber hacks, but expressly to negotiate and let Putin know that this is a new sheriff in town.
Mm. Okay, interesting. We'll be digesting news from Europe, President Biden in Europe over the next few days, undoubtedly. Let's move on to a story that's been with us for several weeks. Chris, to you on this, first of all, of course, Joe Biden's top domestic priority, infrastructure. And yesterday, Joe Biden failing to reach a deal with Senate Republicans on this massive infrastructure plan and signaling he's going to try to find another bipartisan compromise. This was a weeks-long effort to reach this deal with Senate Republicans. The negotiations, I guess, were cut off. Chris, what does this mean now that Biden has failed to persuade the GOP to embrace this bid to pour a trillion dollars into the nation's aging public works system, safety net programs, really broadening the definition of what traditionally has been known as infrastructure?
Well, yeah, I think that there are a few things to think about here. One, obviously, the politics of this in terms of does this, you know, essentially signal a big problem for the Biden administration in terms of what they campaign on for congressional elections in 2022. Do the Democrats go into 2022 without a significant policy achievement because the infrastructure plan has essentially stalled? The other side of this are the procedural things to think about in terms of what does the Biden administration do now? If they want to move forward with this, if they want to push hard, do they still consider the option of trying to remove the filibuster? Do they try to somehow get this written into a budget reconciliation where for next year, when they write up their budget resolution, do they try to include a reconciliation bill for an infrastructure plan? And there's still some talk that they might be able to use the reconciliation process, which goes around the filibuster, doesn't require the 60 vote requirement to get something through the United States Senate. So I think the Biden administration, I mean, there's certainly some frustration with the Biden administration right now because this was a $2.3 trillion plan down to a $1 trillion plan. And then now Republicans are proposing a $300 billion plan. And so I think for the Democrats and for the Biden administration, they feel like they've compromised a great deal, but Republicans are really not moving on this. And so it's forcing the Biden administration to consider these more extreme procedural options that don't really play well in terms of public opinion about wanting compromise from members of Congress.
And Rachel, what do you see here? I see that Biden is shifting his focus now after giving up on those negotiations, cutting them off. A bipartisan group of centrist senators who've been working separately on an alternative. Do you still see a bipartisan path here? Or as Chris referenced there, will, if they have any chance at a deal, would the Democrats have to just go solo here?
Well, first of all, it's not entirely clear that the Democrats can go solo here. Even if they were able to move this into a reconciliation process where they would only need Democratic votes, it's unclear that they have 50 Democratic votes for this bill in its form, in the form that Biden would like. And so that poses a secondary problem for the administration in terms of strategically judging the best path forward. This new proposal has been put together by the House Problem Solvers Caucus, which is kind of perhaps inappropriately named as it includes some senators as well, and they've been in conversation with senators. It's 29 Democrats, 29 Republicans, and they've put forward a compromise bill that they hope might be able to form the basis for renewed conversations. And it's not everything that Biden wants. It's a little less than $800 billion, so it's closer to his $1 trillion. It includes money for highways, road maintenance. It includes money for bridge maintenance and for public transport and for Amtrak, which, of course, is one of Biden's very favorite spending items. For airports, for water, waterways and ports, all the kind of traditional things that we think of as infrastructure. But it also adds some additional money for broadband internet, which, of course, is central to Biden's plan for wastewater and drinking water. And then it also adds some spending for nuclear energy, for connecting a green energy into the electric grid. So it's a little more expansive than just the hard infrastructure projects that Republicans have really focused attention on. This is where Biden, I think, will now direct his attention. We haven't heard a lot yet in terms of whether or not this is a proposal that could potentially, A, attract those centrist Democrats to get to 50 votes, or if it could even possibly form the basis for a larger bill that could get some Republican support in the Senate.
Chris, tell us a little bit about this infrastructure debate focusing on Iowa. Of course, Iowans, we know our infrastructure needs work. The governor also committed to increasing investment in broadband. When we see the Republicans in Congress, our senators, our members of Congress as well, reacting to this infrastructure bill, does it tell you whether they are worried about not being on board with a big infrastructure bill or some kind of infrastructure compromise?
Well, I mean, Yeah, when you think about it in terms of, I think that's one of the interesting things about this bill, right? So there are things in there that match with what Governor Reynolds and Republicans have talked about in this last legislative session in terms of, as you said, broadband expansion. But then if you have federal Republicans opposing the infrastructure bill, it sets up this interesting dynamic in terms of how do voters measure the, the accountability of their elected officials? Because if you have state officials sort of pushing one way on one particular aspect of the infrastructure in terms of broadband, but nationally Republicans are pushing back against an infrastructure bill that includes that particular provision on broadband, how are voters going to process this? And I think that's one of the interesting things going forward. The other side of this is just more generally about what the public thinks about Congress, about the policymaking process generally, because we know for the last 20 plus years, the opinion of Congress is quite low. It takes quite a bit for approval of Congress to get into the 20 percentile range there. And we are at a point where on something that prior to this administration and for the last several years, we've heard members of Congress and members of state legislatures of both parties talking about the need for infrastructure reform, right? And as you said, we've heard about this in Iowa for a long period of time about the need to upgrade our roads, to upgrade our bridges. This was something that came up several years ago in the state legislature with the gas tax about the need for more infrastructure funding. But the fact that we can't seem to get any movement on this, or at least the movement is extremely slow, again, plays into what the public sees about Congress, about an inability to really get anything done. That's one of the big criticisms of Congress, is that there seems to be an inability to get anything done, even when there appears to be bipartisan agreement on the need to get it done. Mm-hmm. Everything gets stopped by the political back and forth.
Yeah. Go back just a few years, and infrastructure used to be the big agreed upon a bipartisan issue that we could agree on. Well, let's move on.
Rachel, jump in for a minute. I mean, mm-hmm. remember that when Donald Trump was running for office, he proposed a $1 trillion infrastructure mm-hmm. plan. That was a hallmark, right? So this is one of those really interesting issues where it has tangible benefits, things that we can see. When our roads are better, when our bridges are better in, across the country, people can see that change. And so in that sense, you'd think that this is something that, elected officials see real advantage to. It's also universal. It touches on every congressional district in every state. Yep. This is why infrastructure has traditionally been bipartisan. And I think in this case, one of the things that happened is that the Biden administration, relying on the fact that infrastructure is traditionally a bipartisan issue, they may have jammed a lot of things into what they called infrastructure in a way that maybe didn't buy them a lot of goodwill with congressional Republicans straight out of the gate, right? They tried to make this about climate change. They tried to make this about building human resources, elder care, child care, and whatever else you may think about whether or not those things are critical infrastructure in the United States. The core point is that those are domestic spending priorities of the Democrats that may have pushed this infrastructure bill into territory where they started at a point where they weren't able to build the bipartisanship that infrastructure traditionally receives.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Just listening to Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, the other part of our duo today of analysts, both professors of political science at their respective institutions. Join our conversation. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Well, since President Biden took office in January, the number of migrants taken into custody per month at the southern border has risen to the highest levels in 20 years. Yesterday, on her first trip abroad since taking office, our Vice President Kamala Harris told Mexican President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador that she saw him as a partner in tackling migration. They agreed to deepen economic ties and invest to improve conditions in Central America. Of course, the Biden administration struggling with the number of migrant children and families arriving at our U.S.-Mexican border, mainly from Central America. And Biden has asked his VP to try to solve the issue. Let's listen to what her response was when asked by a reporter in Mexico, why not go to the U.S. southern border as well? Here's how she responded.
Listen, I've been to the border before. I will go again. But when I'm in Guatemala dealing with root causes, I think we should have a conversation about what's going on in Guatemala.
Okay, what's going on here? Rachel, start us off. The challenge here that the vice president has been given and her, well, Republicans would say her obvious neglect of going down to our southern border where at least Americans see the migrant problem most.
Yeah, there are a number of reports that Harris asked to take on this issue. And it seems pretty clear that I don't think anybody questions that she's setting herself up as the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party. And immigration, of course, has been one of the core political issues. The problem I think she faces is that the separation of quote unquote root causes and border conditions, those are absolutely and unavoidably linked in the public consciousness. And so to say, well, I'm just here to address the root causes, not the border, is something that doesn't make a lot of sense to people. And so, you know, she's going to have to come up, I think, with a more compelling way to distinguish those two things, particularly in how she talks about this. But, you know, there were a couple moments during this trip where she met that exact same problem of trying to, you know, the distinction may be obvious to her, but it's not obvious to everybody.
Right, right. And Chris, before I have you weigh in on this, let's listen to the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki on this trip. She said Harris was tasked with the root causes of migration. She said Republicans were foregrounding the border when the conditions that led it to emerge well before Biden took office.
At some point, she may go to the border. I don't have any trips to preview for you or predict or a timeline for that. But what I would reiterate is that her assignment was to work with countries and leaders in the Northern Triangle to address root causes, address corruption, ensure we're working together to address humanitarian concerns. I will say we're not taking advice from former President Trump or most of the Republicans who are criticizing us on this, given they were all sitting there while we created this problem we walked into, both at the border and with the movement of migration that has been growing over the last year. So we're not taking our guidance and advice from them, but if it is constructive and it moves the ball forward for her to visit the border, she certainly may do that.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you think of how the Biden administration is approaching this problem and handling the messaging as we hear here?
Yeah, well, I would agree with Rachel. I think in terms of the public consciousness, as Rachel said on this, it is difficult to separate being in Guatemala, the root causes versus what they see at the border. I think the way the public is reacting to this is that this is still the issue of immigration and that this is still an issue that every administration has been dealing with. And even, you know, the way that this works is that this is happening now under the Biden administration. And if you look at public polling on issues, whether, you know, on the three big issues, at least right now, on the economy, the pandemic or coming out of the pandemic, and then on immigration, the Biden administration polls the lowest on immigration. So the public still sees this as a problem. And so for the Biden administration, for Kamala Harris, this is going to be a very difficult issue going forward. And you know, if she, you know, she's trying to take leadership on this issue, but, you know, it's not the same as infrastructure, but certainly with immigration, there have been attempts in the past to try to address this issue, to try to come to some sort of bipartisan agreement. We saw this with, you know, the group of eight senators back in 2013. And there have been attempts over a number of years to try to address this issue. And it really, we really haven't seen any movement on it, and it has become a very partisan issue. And so I think this is probably the number one most difficult issue for the Biden administration in terms of trying to convince the public that there is, you know, positive movement on this, because all they read about or all that the public is hearing is all the negative things that are happening at the border.
Yeah. And Rachel, in terms of the Republican Party, how much motivation do they have to find a solution, a better solution, a better path than we have right now? I mean, immigration, the border wall, was the, you could arguably say, the number one issue that revved up the Trump base in recent years. So why would they want to help Biden solve that is a thought.
Well, I think that's right. And I think this is true for both parties at various points. Remember, of course, that during the Trump administration, it was Democrats traveling to the border and decrying the horrible conditions at the border. Now it's Republicans going to the border and decrying the horrible conditions at the border. You know, politically, because there is no easy answer, and this goes back to the Obama administration, this goes back to the George W. Bush administration, this goes back to, I mean, yeah, you can trace this all the way back. Right. So as the problem continues and as the problem has been increasingly politicized, we're talking about real people. We're talking about real lives. And so stoking that anger and frustration and outrage is a very compelling way to energize your party's base on both sides. Whichever party is currently responsible for dealing with it is oftentimes going to get the short end of the stick on that.
Right. And we have a couple minutes before we go to break. Speaking of drawing the short end of the stick or the shortest straw, some would say that Vice President Harris drew a couple of short straws in terms of her tasks, both immigration and voting rights. We'll talk about that in the second half hour. Politically fraught problems, no easy solutions. And talk about this for the very briefly before we go to break. Some Democrats, I've been reading, worried that tasking Harris with such difficult issues, since she is positioned as a presidential nominee in waiting, Chris, what do you think about the, you know, she's not being given fluff things to do as vice president?
No, she hasn't. And that's the real question, is that if she is a candidate in 2024, if Joe Biden decides not to run for re-election, will it be difficult for her to campaign without significant policy achievements or at least significant policy movement on these two issues? And so far, as you both have talked about with immigration, that's a very difficult issue to get movement on. And then moving over to voting rights, the trend across the country has been for, at least in Republican-controlled legislatures, is to move in a direction of restricting voting rights. So she has a real challenge there in terms of addressing this very quick movement in state legislatures that's going against what the Democratic Party nationally is trying to do with things like the For the People Act and other pieces of legislation where they're trying to ease restrictions. So she has an incredible task in front of her on both.
Okay, Rachel, 30 seconds to you, perhaps teeing up what we'll talk about in the second half hour, voting rights and the forces at work federally and in states.
Yeah, and again, reports are that she asked for both of these issues. They're issues that animate the Democratic base. So I think she's really counting on, at the very least, putting her stamp on these issues and making herself known as somebody who wants to wade into these thorny topics.
Okay, more thorny topics ahead, commented on by Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. We'll talk about our state auditor, Rob Sands' claim of improper use of federal coronavirus aid as well. And as Donald Trump reemerges at rallies, we saw him in the last weekend, will he retain his grip on the Republican Party? Join our conversation, Ben Kiefer, back with Rachel Caulfield and Chris Larimer in just a moment.
Iowa is known far and wide for corn and soybeans, but those of us who live here know that Iowa is so much more. I'm Charity Nebbe. From agriculture to high culture, each day on Talk of Iowa, I talk to farmers, artists, authors, musicians, scientists, athletes, and others who make Iowa what it is. Talk of Iowa, weekday mornings at 10 on Iowa Public Radio.
And we're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Chris Larimer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Likewise, Rachel Caulfield, Professor of Political Science, but at Drake University. We invite you to join our conversation as we survey about a half dozen topics, political news topics, both from a national level and a state level. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. We want to talk about the interesting dynamic between what state legislatures, including Iowa, is doing in terms of reforming election law, and contrast that what the Democrats are trying to do in Congress at a national level. But before we go to that, let's have you comment, please, Rachel and Chris, about a recent story that you may agree starts the, maybe signals the start of a campaign for the 2022 gubernatorial election. We must remind ourselves that the 2022 election is less than a year and a half away. Last week, our state auditor, Rob Sand, definitely seen as a potential Democratic challenger to Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, accused her of improperly using federal coronavirus aid dollars for, in his words, self-promotion. Reynolds has denied the claim, defended the spending of nearly $150,000 on public awareness advertising related to COVID-19 mitigation. Republicans accusing Sand of playing the issue for political gain. Let's listen to a little bit of this video from November that's in question and have Chris explain what's at the heart of the issue. Reynolds appears alongside big Iowa names in this video, like the CEO of the University of Iowa Hospital, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, Olympic wrestler Dan Gable, asking Iowans to wear a mask during the coronavirus pandemic. Here's a taste of audio from that video.
COVID-19 isn't stronger than Iowans' resolve to overcome it.
Together, we can stop the spread of the virus and get life back to normal.
By taking simple steps to protect ourselves and others.
Wear a mask and maintain social distance.
Wash your hands and disinfect commonly used items.
Stay home if you're sick and get tested if you think you have COVID-19.
If you do, isolate from others to avoid spreading the virus.
Chris Larimer, explain what's at issue here.
Well, what's at issue, at least according to State Auditor Rob Sand, is that this video, this public awareness campaign, was produced, as he said, with taxpayer funds. But this is, as he called it, quote, self-promotion with taxpayer funds, and that this is prohibited. And so it's, you know, goes back to, you know, kind of the basics of campaign finance, that with taxpayer funds, if you're in office, you cannot self-promote. For Governor Reynolds, she argues, and her staff argues, that this was an emergency order, that she that this was not an illegal use of funds. And I think what makes the issue difficult for Rob Sand a little bit, at least in terms of public opinion, is that, as you said, this was a video that featured a number of different prominent Iowans, including a former Democratic governor. So you had the current Republican governor and a former Democratic governor of Iowa, and Tom Vilsack. You know, I think going forward, I think it's still a little bit early to know how this is going to affect the campaign. But if nothing else, as you said, this does sort of elevate Rob Sand to probably the number one challenger for Governor Reynolds at this point, even though he has not officially declared his candidacy for governor. I think most people do look to Rob Sand as being the most likely Democratic nominee at this point in the process. So potentially trying to set himself up against Governor Reynolds and set himself up in a way where he is challenging her leadership on the pandemic. But again, the difficult issue is this was, at least in terms of public opinion, is that this was a video that was produced at the height of the pandemic. It was produced where, in a way where there was a former Democratic governor. So it comes across as a bipartisan video. So I think, you know, it's just a little bit early to know how this is going to play out legally, but at least in terms of the politics of it, it certainly presents itself as this is going to be the two-person race in November of 2022.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, and did you want to get in on this before we moved in on that scuffle and the potential matchup? Of course you do. Of course you do.
Oh, well, I mean, maybe I agree with everything that Chris just said.
Okay.
This is where that thin line exists between official responsibilities and self-promotion in a campaign environment. And the statute, which is a relatively new statute, I mean, it was passed in 2018. It's broadly worded. It does seem to have an opening clause that allows the governor to suspend the law in times of emergency. Rob Sand alleges that there's no evidence the governor actually acted to suspend the law in this case, and so therefore that's not legitimate. But there's always, in these sorts of situations, there's always a fine line between asking our elected officials to be our public voices in leading response to something like a pandemic, and at the same time recognizing that they are ubiquitously preparing for the next campaign. That's the nature of the beast. And so this is a kind of particularly awkward situation, precisely because one could argue that Rob Sand is doing exactly the same thing. He's performing his official responsibilities, but also really elevating his statewide, statewide image in preparation for a campaign. So,
okay. We'll see how that develops. And as we move towards 2022, who will inevitably, who will vie for that nomination, the Democratic nomination to face Governor Reynolds. Let's move on to election law changes across the country and here in Iowa. This week, Governor Reynolds signing a law restricting who can help Iowa voters return their absentee ballot. Previously here in the state, previous elections allowed Iowans were allowed to designate anyone to return their ballot to the county auditor, for instance, throw it in a drop box or through the mail. Now, only an immediate family member, a household member, or a delivery agent following strict rules can help return the ballot, and they have to return it in person to the county auditor, raising concerns that it'll be harder for some people, perhaps older, disabled voters, to return their ballot. Senate Democratic leader Zach Walls says this, and the earlier changes shortening the time allowed for voting stem from unfounded claims of a stolen election. That's the state view. And just to paint the election, the national view, before I have comment from Chris and Rachel on this, eyes have been on Senator Joe Manchin. Yesterday morning, he met with civil rights leaders. He praised that meeting, but maintained his opposition to a sweeping set of election overhaul measures known as the For the People Act. He has announced his opposition to this elections reform and voting rights bill. Chris, take this on first of all here. Also, an interesting dynamic. State legislators acting in one way because they're in the control of the Republicans, and the Democrats in control in the House and the Senate acting in another way.
Yeah, that's right. And there's really a lot going on here. As you said, you know, on the one hand, you have a lot of movement on voting rights at the state level, which is what we mentioned right before the break. If you go to the Brennan Center for Justice on their website, they track all the legislation related to voting rights moving at the state level. And they report that as of May 14th of this year, legislators have introduced, this is according to their website, 389 bills with restrictive provisions in 48 different states. So there has been an incredible amount of movement at the state level, and particularly in Republican-controlled legislatures, in the direction of more restrictive voting rights, or at least restricting the existing voting rights, or at least voting provisions within a particular state. So for you mentioned for the state of Iowa with the new election law that went into effect in Iowa, signed by Governor Reynolds. You mentioned the movement in terms of more restrictions surrounding absentee ballots. Mm-hmm. It cut Iowa's early voting period from 29 days down to 20. Polls closed an hour earlier at 8 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. And that's what we're seeing across states where Republicans have control. What the Democrats are trying to do nationally is move in the other direction with H.R. 1, the For the People Act, to expand voter registration, to allow for automatic voter registration, same-day voter registration, at least keep that early voting window at a minimum of 15 days, to at least require 10 hours of voting on election day. So you do see this back and forth between what national Democrats want to do and what, at the state level, Republicans in many state legislatures are already doing, and things that are already being signed into law. And so this is going to take a lot of time to work out, because the states are moving very, very quickly on this issue, whereas nationally the Democrats, they are running into some roadblocks with individual senators, because of the way the rules work in the United States Senate, that you can have an individual like Senator Joe Manchin really hold this up and with a 50-50 Senate. So they're not able to get a lot of movement. And at the same time, states are moving very quickly, right? We often mm-hmm. talk about in the policy world that, you know, states are the, quote, the laboratories of democracy, to quote a former Supreme Court justice. And so and that's what we're seeing. They're just moving so quickly. And we always see that at the state level, that they can move much quicker on public policy. And so Democrats are trying to catch up, and they are so far behind right now on this issue nationally.
And Rachel, what do you see as at stake here in the possible scenarios going forward with election laws?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to contextualize the provisions that have been passed in Iowa. I think almost universally, if not entirely, would be consistent with the For the People Act, H.R. 1, mm-hmm. that's been proposed by the Democrats. So, you know, when you just compare state voting provisions, mm-hmm. even these restrictive measures in Iowa are far superior to voting practices in a lot of other states. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important to just kind of put into context that what's happening in Iowa is not the worst of the worst. This is actually comparatively a fairly minor change. But I think most people don't realize the extent to which, as Chris said, the extent to which our elections are not nationalized. Election rules are state driven and oftentimes even locally driven. And so this clash that we're seeing at the national level, because so much of our politics is now nationalized, we're having this conversation at the national level. I think we're oftentimes conflating debates at the state and local level with the debate that's happening at the national level. And to some extent, they are different debates. As the case of Iowa may point out. So it's obviously an animating issue right now for both Democrats and Republicans. And it is, in a polarized political world, it is therefore something that both parties want to act on, and they want to act quickly. I agree with Chris that the messaging and the legislative action, Democrats are playing catch up with Republicans in terms of how they want to address this issue, not only at the national level, but at the state legislative level. And so it's going to be an ongoing debate. I also think it's interesting that this is one of those places where the courts are inevitably going to settle a lot of these disputes. Mm-hmm. And many of those will be state courts. And so in this case, you're really looking at a situation where all of the branches of government at all levels of government are trying to resolve similar questions and will come up with widely divergent answers. And that's going to go on, I suspect, for years.
Mm-hmm. To finish up this, I wanted to zoom out. I don't know if you heard an NPR piece from Morning Edition this morning talking about, well, some wondering whether the U.S. is sliding towards so-called minority rule. More and more Democrats saying the system is out of whack. We, of course, know that twice in the last 20 years, the presidential candidate got more votes but lost the election. And right now, in according to that report, we have the Senate split evenly in half, but 50 Democratic senators represent more than 41 million more people than the Republicans' 50 senators. And according to this report today, that by 2040, if population trends continue, 70% of Americans will be represented by 30 senators, and 30% of Americans will be represented by 70 senators. Chris, what do you think about this worry of minority rule and people wondering why is the Senate the way it is?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, this is something that was an issue in Iowa when Iowa was, going through reforms related to redistricting in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where there was the political geography of the state was very much out of balance in terms of where voters were residing and the movement among voters within Iowa to more urban areas away from rural areas. And this is something that has continued, but Iowa had to put in minimum requirements around, populations and the majority of where the majority would come from. So this is going to, I think this is inevitable. This is going to continue where if we continue to see a rural-urban divide where with more people moving to more urban areas or suburban areas, this has the potential to get at that issue of minority rule. I mean, and the other side, another point on this minority rule, you can also think of this in terms of the filibuster itself. That, you know, if you're in the minority, but if you're in the United States Senate and you can use the filibuster, does this essentially allow the minority to control the policymaking process, right? To the issues that we've talked about earlier with infrastructure and immigration, where if there's an objection from the minority party, because of the filibuster rule, they can control the policy agenda. So, this is something that, like I said, I think it's going to continue. I think it's going to continue to present some real differences between rural and urban interests, but it's something that we've already seen in Iowa and other states are dealing with it as well.
Mm-hmm. We have just 5 minutes left of our program. I wanted to get to this final point. Over the weekend, the former President Donald Trump delivering a keynote speech in North Carolina, repeating unproven allegations of widespread election fraud in the last presidential election, which he lost. Here's some of what he had to say on the weekend.
We're not a 50-50 country to defund the police and to have sanctuary cities where criminals are allowed to be protected. I'm telling you, I think a lot of these elections where they always seem to have an advantage, I don't believe it. I can't believe that some of these states that are blue, that they're blue. I know those people. They're smart people. And I see so many people. They love me because they love what I stand for. And they're not into these things. There's something going on. And we have to be very, very careful with our election process. Because I don't believe we're a 50-50 nation where these states are split evenly. They can't be split. This is corrupt elections, possibly, and we can't allow it to go on.
Okay, repeating unfounded claims there, baseless claims. Rachel, talk about this. Why shouldn't he be non-traditional in the role of a defeated president, one-term president? So what is his role now? What will it be in the future?
Well, I think that is the magic question. I think it's the magic question for Republicans in particular. But I also think it's the magic question for Democrats. Similarly, a report came out from, similarly to the debates that are going on in the Republican Party right now, a report came out from three Democratic activist groups that really pointed to the fact that so much of the Democrats' rhetoric in 2020 was anti-Trump rather than a positive, coherent economic message that really appealed to a broad base of voters. And they specifically put together this report to warn the Democratic Party for the 2022 and 2024 election cycles to kind of point out, look, the party needs to really focus on how you're going to maintain that base of Democratic support that allowed Joe Biden to win in 2020. And it's not going to be by always running against Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, I mean, Trump's rally over the weekend, it was a greatest hits moment. It was also, however, interestingly, politically safe in many ways. He didn't have to build a crowd. He spoke to an existing Republican state Republican convention that was happening. So he knew that the room would be full. He knew it would be a sympathetic crowd. So it was kind of a soft launch on kind of reemerging into public life and potentially paving a path for a 2024 candidacy, which I know a lot of people hear that and it makes them deeply uncomfortable on a number of different levels. But I think it's a reality that both mm-hmm. parties have to really confront. This is a man who clearly is not interested in fading into a polite, typical role.
Mm-hmm. Chris, this question to you, especially for the listeners who are conservative, politically conservative, not fans of Trump. Does the anti-Trump faction within the GOP, we'll call it the Lynn Cheney faction, perhaps, have a chance of retaking control of the Republican Party anytime soon?
I think that's difficult to say because we don't know the extent to which Trump is going to try to dominate the 2022 campaign, congressional campaigns with his mm-hmm. attendance at rallies. I mean, if he is a dominant force and a very visible presence and a constant presence, I think that's going to be difficult because his presence really, if it's like the rally that we were just listening to, that's really going back to old issues, as you said, about the unfounded claims about election security, trying to create fear about immigration that prevents that anti-Trump faction from having conversations about new policy issues or new policy positions or trying to talk about existing policy debates, for example, on infrastructure. That essentially drowns out those conversations. And so I think it's too early to tell because we don't know what role or how prominent the former president is going to be going into the 2022 campaign.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we've come to the end of our program. We have to end it sometime. We had plenty of other talking points, issues to discuss, as well as listeners on our phones that will have to chime in on a future program. I want to thank the two of you, Chris Larimer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, Rachel Caulfield, Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Rachel and Chris, thanks for teaming up today and giving us some of your insights. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
River to River, today produced by Zachary Oren Smith, together with Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tune in again tomorrow for another edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Until then.